Welcome back to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, the resident film correspondent at Express FM and presenter and producer of their film music programme, The Composer Series, which can be found weekly on Sundays at 6pm in the UK. By the way, also happy to say I am co-host and producer of our other film podcast on this very channel, We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, as well as very proud to be a regular contributor to Film Score Monthly. Joining me for each Scoreheads episode is my good friend Sean Wilson, who himself is the author of the excellent book The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music from the Silence to the Present, as well as having been in some cases and continuing to be in others a regular contributor of superb work to such outlets as Cineworld, Flickering Myth, the BBC, Hey You Guys and Composer Magazine. He's also no stranger to a podcast either, having regular, engaging and insightful conversations on such podcasts as Between the Notes, Frame to Frame and Right Here on Scoreheads. And so to the business of this latest episode, where Sean and I had a warm, informative and very funny conversation with one of the most celebrated and often talked about composers of the moment, the multi-award winning and very brilliant Hilda Gunnadottir. If you're hearing about her for the first time today, Hilda is a multi-award-winning Icelandic musician and composer who has garnered praise for her work scoring cinematic films such as Sicario, Day of the Soldado, Todd Field's critically acclaimed film Tar, Sarah Polley's exceptional picture Women Talking, and Todd Phillips' outstanding DC Comics movie Joker, for which her superb score won her the trifecta, a Golden Globe, a BAFTA, and an Oscar. She's also no stranger to home entertainment either, having garnered much deserved praise and awards for her craft in the creation of the score to hit series Chernobyl, and has even expertly tackled the soundscapes of the video game realm with her husband Sam Slater on the game Battlefield 2042. Lately, she's been working closely with director Kenneth Branagh, composing the score for A Haunting in Venice, which is the latest entry into his film adaptations as director and star of the great work of the late Agatha Christie. Sean and I caught up with the magnificent Hilda to talk more about her creative process and on scoring The Sound of Poirot's World.
Please understand, madam, I would welcome with open arms any honest sign of devil or demon or ghost. For if there is a ghost, there is a soul. If there is a soul, there is a God who made it. And if we have God, we have everything, meaning, order, justice. But I have seen too much of the world, countless crimes, two wars, the bitter evil of human indifference, and I conclude, no.
After that quite extensive intro, which Hilda didn't hear yet, but we assure you, Hilda, it was incredibly praising. Sean and I are very happy now to give a huge warm welcome to Hilda, who joins us now on this very show. Welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
We're doing great. Sean's very excited. It's the first time Sean's spoken with you, so yeah. He's a huge fan.
It's I'm actually beaming.
It's
lovely to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure, and it's a great pleasure to speak with you for a second time. I've been really looking forward to this as well. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us and to talk about a few projects, actually, I'm sure. But in the main, your wonderful score for A Haunting in Venice. So let's start, I think, at the beginning of that project and talk about how you got involved with it and what drew you to wanting to write music for it.
Yeah, well, I grew up reading Agatha Christie novels and crime novels and detective stories. So I grew up reading like all the kind of classics like Nancy Drew and Sherlock Holmes and Poirot and all of these detectives, and it's kind of just, you know, something that everyone in my family seemed to do, especially my grandmother, who was an avid crime novel reader, and she claimed that it was the only way to get a break from your own mind was to read a good crime novel. So I was kind of raised on that, and I guess having spent so much time with this genre, you know, you kind of form certain ideas about what you think is right for the genre. So I had some like very specific ideas about what music I think is appropriate for this genre and what kind of approach is appropriate. And I'm quite Yeah, I guess I'm quite conservative. I guess, you know, when your grandmother is your main crime mother, conservatism kind of comes with a generation, I guess. So I was quite keen when Ken invited me on board. I was quite keen to get to sink my teeth into the story, and I was really excited that he wanted to do a slightly darker approach than the previous films he had done, and that he also, being obviously a big crime fan, he was also kind of quite keen on the classical approach, and he saw it quite a lot as a chamber piece, and I thought that fit really well to the story and to the setting. So I felt like our ideas were in total alignment, and he was also keen on having the score rather atonal in tonality, which I also thought fit really well to this time and to this particular story, because I think that Poirot is, when we spend a lot more time with Poirot himself in this film than we do in many other of these stories, and I thought that was quite interesting, because I think he's processing quite a lot of his experience around the war, you know, he's suffering from PTSD in a way, and he's looking at what happened to him before the war, during the war, and after the war, and I felt that was so connected to the same questions that composers of this time were asking themselves, like, you know, what in a world that's being torn apart and has literally crumpled, like how do you move forward with your creativity and your tonality, really, and I felt there was, just in music history, such a clear line that's happening in the tonality. You know, composers are really trying to throw everything out the window that they, or I mean, forward thinking composers, obviously not everyone, but the ones that are really, you know, prone to experimentation are really throwing the old ideas about, you know, melody and harmony out with the pre-war times. So I thought it was quite interesting to frame the score and the timeline in that sense of direction of the tonality. So, you know, all the parts of the story that happen in the kind of pre-war times have these kind of more romantic, melodic approach to them, and then the space that's sitting kind of in between the times, you know, that are sitting between the supernatural and the natural, they have a kind of slightly more spacious aspect to the melodic approach. So they're like kind of not atonal, but not fully tonal either. So I thought that was really interesting, like how you can create a almost like a non-feel spatial quality to like a melodic approach, so to say, or non-melodic approach, in order to bridge romanticism into the atonal approach, which I saw more kind of as a way forward, like as the palazzo in the story kind of crumbles and we get closer to the answers of the story, and the world kind of so moves forward, so to say, the melodic approach becomes much more like atonal as we're moving forward somehow. So I just thought it was a really interesting way to work for me, you know, in a kind of, you know, deeply personal connection to the genre, but also just a kind of historical exploration of, you know, what was happening in music of this time, and just kind of having fun with exploring a very classical approach to the score. So I would say this is probably my most classical score to date. So there's no, you know, there's no new instruments or field recordings or any fancy tricks. It's really straightforward written music, which is very intentionally, you know, classical, and sitting in a space that's supporting the story and the narrative much more than kind of leading the character narration, but it's more kind of like setting the tone for the historical surroundings, so to say.
It's lovely hearing you say, Hilda, your connection to the stories in the first place, because I'm from Torquay and Agatha Christie was born 2 minutes up the road from where my parents still live in Torquay. So there's a lot of history. So it's lovely to hear you sort of professing your love for the genre and for her work. And I wondered, like, did you have a favourite story of hers, like when you were growing up? Was there one that particularly stood out to you?
No, not
it's
really.
An easy it's question, I apologize.
Yeah, that is a hard, that is a kind of hard question, yeah. Because I think they, there's one title that really sticks with me a lot, which is, I don't even know if it's the same title in English, but in Icelandic it's like Elephant Don't Forget. Elephants Don't Forget.
Okay.
I don't know. I read a lot of
it. It could be the
Icelandic,
same, yeah.
Yeah.
It could be.
But that's, yeah. That's a title that keeps popping up for me. But I think for some reason, a lot of these, because I definitely do read a lot of crime novels, and they tend to kind of go in and out straightforward. Like I don't reminiscence on a lot of these stories. You know, they're kind of, I feel like they're so, the beauty of them is that they're so inviting for the reader to participate, you know. So I think it's a very, I think you have to be very present when you're,
you have to keep up with breadcrumbs that she puts
exactly. So and I guess because you're so present, like when you're reading these stories, like to what's happening at the time, then somehow the stories don't really sit very long.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Because then I'm just like, okay, next.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always And Then There Were None, I think, is my favorite, because it's just such a fiendishly good. I mean, I'm hoping that there'll be a film adaptation of that, and that you might be able to score it, because that's my favorite one of hers. It's just so complicated. You know, like, how is this happening? And at the end, it's like it's a proper lot jaw dropping reveal, even by Agatha Christie's standards. It's extraordinary. Yeah,
great. I'll have to revisit that.
Yeah,
I spoke to James Pritchard, the executive producer, who is of course actually Agatha Christie's grandson, and we were talking about what book would he choose if he sat down with Ken and had the choice to choose a book. And I think he said he'd like to see the ones that go back to kind of the old English village, those kind of stories, and he'd love to bring maybe one of those to life in a cinematic setting. But do you, following on from Sean's question, would that, you were talking about Elephants Never Forget, would that be the book, if you saw that adapted to film, would that be the one you'd like to score? If you got to choose which book you could score, which one would it be, if you could? Would it be that one?
Again, like, it's so hard to, it's really hard for me to choose. I think it's also so connected just to the approach for the whole film, you know, because you have a story and then you have an adaptation, so it's so bound to just like what the approach for you know, telling the story is. I think it's not just the story, but it's just like, okay, how are we telling the story, you know, that I think it's so important. And that was so, I thought that was so fun about Haunting in Venice, you know, which is based on this book called The Halloween Party. And it's very, they take a lot of, you know, space with the adaptation, you know, they really add a lot. So it's very different from the book itself, actually. And I think that's also kind of what made it quite interesting. You know, so it's not just the story, but it's everything yes. else that comes with it, you know, so... So I think that, adds an extra layer to it being very difficult to answer. <this part.
laughs> You mentioned the word approach there, and I wondered how much your intuition of what the music can be is informed by what the director brings to it, because obviously from film to film, approaches and stylistics will change. So how much is it a collaborative process between you and a filmmaker, like, for example, Kenneth Branagh?
Yeah, it's a really big collaboration, because I think you really have to make sure that you're on the same page to begin with. And Ken was just so marvelous to work with, because he was so, you know, he's so incredibly clear with what he's doing, and that makes the whole creative process so wonderful because you're always on this kind of, you're always on the same path. Like you can, you know, you can explore and experiment a lot, like on that journey, but the path is always very clear, you know, and that was really wonderful. He never really changed his mind about the film that he was making, you know, and that can be the kind of what makes or breaks a collaboration, is like just making sure that you're on the same path the whole time, you know, with everyone. And because yeah, I mean, I think it's always just really important to have an open dialogue, I think, with a director, and to make sure that you're listening well enough to be able to translate also what the director is trying to say, because it doesn't, directors are not always, you know, they don't necessarily have like a strong musical vocabulary, you know, so it's always just like, you know, it's always this interesting dialogue of like, okay, what, you know, what is the story that we're telling, and how do we want to tell it, and what instruments are we bringing in, like what is the world, what is the universe, and I think that's all, you know, a close dialogue is definitely always the most helpful on that journey, you know. And Ken is just, he's like a truly wonderful collaborator, because not only is he very clear and direct and knows exactly what he wants, but he's also very inviting to everyone. I think everyone has a lot of space to bring their ideas to the table, and he's like, he's so open to what everyone has to say, and he's like so incredibly just, yeah, generous and wonderful, you know, such a lovely, lovely person. Mm. So it's like a true delight to get to work with him.
It must have been a lot of fun as well, right? I mean, he's wonderful to work with, but also a story that has many layers, but is also quite scary. It's a scary movie as well. It must have been an incredible amount of fun to write music for.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Also because, you know, I think that element and the supernatural element was a pretty fun way to go about it, because it has this just additional layer of mind game for the audience, you know. It's not just figuring out who done it, but also like, is this real, is this not real, is this a, you know, is it a ghost, is it a kid, or, you know. So you know, it really was quite a lot of fun. And I think a lot of this music also, you know, which was so interesting of this time, which, you know, this orchestration wise, you know, the ways that composers in the post-war era are like experimenting with extended playing techniques like multiphonics and they're called and stuff like this for particularly wind instruments, you know, there's a lot of experimentation at this time with techniques, and I think those sounds, they lend themselves so well to this kind of the horror,
yeah, element. Eeriness.
So it was really quite fun to record all of that, and I feel like, you know, a lot of these scenes just kind of brought themselves almost, because it's like, you know,
yeah,
so yeah. Hilarious, you know, and so classical and horror-y. So it was quite fun.
In terms of the instrumentation itself, so we've discussed like the techniques and the aesthetic approach to the music. In terms of the makeup of the music, what are the core instruments that are located within the score?
Well, it's kind of, you know, the approach was looking at it almost like a chamber ensemble. And so it's mostly strings and woods. And they're all quite small, the ensembles, you know. I really wanted to kind of play with size and expectation a bit as well, in order to kind of trick the audience to lean forward a bit and listen. So I was playing quite a lot with you know, scenes that where you kind of expect like very grand, big orchestral music, and I was playing with going the exact opposite direction. So some of these scenes, like when he's he's sailing on this gondola and you see these, you know, big fireworks and stuff, and you would kind of imagine this kind of blah, you know, kind of gorgeous Venice music, and it's just like a solo clarinet. That really brings our focus, like, you know, towards like a much more intimate place, I think, because it's so sparse, the orchestration. So I was playing with a lot of scale and expectation in the score. So it's quite, it's quite small, really, which I thought was really nice, you know, in the setting.
And you were talking about your grandmother being a huge Agatha Christie fan, and then you're working with Kenneth Branagh. How does one grapple with that? Because there must be a feeling of pressure that comes with that grandeur, not just from a professional level, because this is a huge project. It's a huge project with a huge director and star, but also on a personal level, of course, a whole family of fans. How did you feel that pressure, and how did you process it, if you did, in order to come out with the beautiful score that we've got?
Well, I try to, you know, as much as I can, ignore any sense of pressure, you know, because I just think it doesn't, I mean, first of all, my grandmother passed away, so she's no longer with us. So I, you know, I kind of just, you know, a lot of this music, I was kind of, in my head, I was kind of having a dialogue with her slightly.
Because
she was a really, no kind of person, and, mm-hmm. and she was a brilliant scientist. She was a virologist and really, really hardworking. And she would always, you know, I remember her, for example, coming into an old flat that I used to have that I also used as a studio. And she came in there and she said, "Well, this is a pretty nice place. I mean, if you say that you can't work here, it's nothing against the place. It's all in your own head. Like, you have to deal with that yourself if you say that you can't do your work here." And I hadn't even said anything about it, but I always remember that, you know, when I'm struggling with a sense of expectation or ego or kind of these existential ideas, I think back on her kind of coming in and just being like, "Get your head off your ass and just, like, you know, show up and do the work." You know? So I Amazing. Kind of, I think of her, you know, every day in that sense. And so that is really, I mean, it can be hard sometimes, obviously, because obviously I'm aware of, you know, the size and stuff, but I really just try to, as much as I can, I try to stay offline and, you know, not read reviews and not immerse myself in any of the press side of things, because I think that it doesn't really help the creative process to soak in the
no of course
the pressure.
yeah And if you're happy and the director's happy, then what else matters, right?
Exactly. You just show up for every project and you just try to do your best, and that's, you know, that's really all you can do.
The quote that Jerry Goldsmith said, which is, when one is composing, that it's okay to be scared of the intimidating task that lies ahead in terms of just putting the music on the page. And Jerry Goldsmith said, "You accept the fear that goes with it." And I wondered, like, do you feel that does that kind of, like, do you get that kind of sense of fear and anxiety? Does that, like, propel you forwards to find, like, new ideas and new sounds?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in the world of film music, more than perhaps just writing music for yourself, it's this the added sense of time pressure that you sometimes have as well. Mm. So, you know, you might just have like a couple of hours to just write the God knows how much music. You know? So I think there's, you know, there's the sense of not being able to write music at all, and then there's also the sense of fear of not being able to write the music within the time that you have to write it. So yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of fear elements that you have to deal with when you're thinking. But I think it's what you kind of, you have to just try to fool yourself that you're not feeling that.
it's not quite denial, but it's something else.
It's really, you can call it denial. You can be very safe. You can't deny.
Let's just talk ourselves out of that one. Did you have a lot more time on that? What was the kind of timing like to have and write and prepare the score? You were having lovely conversations with Ken, obviously, but did you have enough time? Was it a comfortable process?
Yes, yeah. I mean, normally I try to, exactly, because I don't really enjoy having this kind of deadline pressure. So I much more enjoy starting projects really early. So, and that's because of a few reasons. Like, I really like when the music can really be a part of setting the tone for the whole project. You know, so for me, it's best to come in basically during, you know, before they start shooting, even, you know, so we can have music on set, and the music can kind of set the pacing and the feel of the set, and therefore like kind of seep into the DNA of the film. You know, I think for me that's a really organic and natural way of working, because and it's slightly more open also, because it's you have a bit less of this time pressure feeling, and then also you just have more time to figure out what it is that you're doing with the director as they're also figuring it out, you know. So for this film, I came in kind of as they were shooting, so I started to write the music just like, you know, when they were wrapping up, and they were playing a lot of my music on set as well, so my tonality was kind of hovering over the set, and chamber piece, I really wanted to record the music as soon as I could, so I wrote a lot of music in the beginning and then recorded it right away, so they could have the pieces like as actual pieces of music, like during the editing process, and not just like mock-up sample banks of stuff. So a lot of the core pieces were there in the very beginning of the editing process, and they were like recorded with a real chamber orchestra, so it felt very organic and real and tangible from the very, very get-go. And I think that was and then of course, you know, as you start editing and as the film starts developing and of course changing, you know, I would write more music to respond to it, and then, you know, we would record the rest, the end. But I think the benefit of doing it like this was that it felt like a very kind of solid piece, you know, the whole way through. And a lot of the scenes, like for example, piece that's called Confession, which is like this 8-9 minute violin solo with a chamber orchestra, that pretty much stayed the same. Like, you know, I added like a bar to that piece at the end. So it was really, you know, that piece is really written like that. Like, you know, and I'm really quite I like when you can approach music like that, when the music is not just like following a scene, but it's really comes together as a piece.
Yeah, I suppose is it the idea of music acting as a commentary or as a Greek chorus over the sequence, so the music kind of sits above the scene? I mean, which I suppose is kind of appropriate for this film, isn't it? Because we don't know what fate these characters are going to meet. We don't know who's going to die. We don't know who's the killer and so on.
Yeah. You don't want to give too much away with the music either.
Yeah.
You just want to keep it open for the you know, for the audience to make up their minds about what they think is going on.
I mean, that must be a real, when the story does rely on twists and turns and key reveals at certain moments, I imagine that must be a real challenge not to give away, not to lean too much into it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to be really careful. Also, because when you've been working on a film for so long, and you've been working on a genre like this for so long, you know, of course that, you know, the edit gets tighter and tighter and keeps changing how the plot is revealed or not revealed, and then you kind of start to lose sight, like, because you know, of course, like all along who's done it.
Yeah.
Like, well, is that obvious, or is this do they know? No, but, you know. So it can be tricky to keep an eye on not revealing too much.
You were just talking about music playing on set there. Of course, famously, that's what happened with Joker, right? With the bathroom dance and everything else, which reminds me, which I need to circle back around to Joker and your Oscar, because many awards for, not just the Oscar, of course, many awards for that. But I think we spoke just before that happened. So I did. I always wanted to ask you. I've been waiting 4 years to ask you this question. What was that like from your point of view, from your perspective, to walk up on that stage and pick up that Oscar? How did that feel from your point of view?
It was terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. I think the one thing that, you know, because you have like a minute to walk up there and say everything you want to say and get out, you know, so you have an incredibly short amount of time. So it's absolutely nerve-wracking to just... you know, I think what mostly went through my head was just like, don't fall down. Because, you know, you're on heels and, you know, tight dress and all of this. So it's, yeah, it was absolutely terrifying. But also, you know, it becomes also so surreal. I mean, I guess also much more so in my case, you know, because right after we just had COVID, you know, I went through this larger than life situation with all these awards, and you know, I'm someone that doesn't really leave the house or leave the studio that much, you know, and all of a sudden I was like, you know, around people all of the just like, wow, like really, really overwhelmed with all of it, and then of course like peaked at the Oscars, and it's like boom, lockdown, you know. So, and then again, like, you know, I didn't see anyone again for like almost what, 2.5 years or whatever, and so it almost feels like it just happened to someone else, you know, in another lifetime. I almost feel like it wasn't like, it didn't actually happen, you know.
Fever dream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, yeah. When people ask me this, I was like, wait a minute, who was that? You know,
when, for example, like John just mentioned it there, when you have arranged the music before they start filming and then it is played on the set with an actor like Joaquin Phoenix reacting to it, like, do you go onto the set to like watch the impact, or would you rather not engage with that and not be influenced by seeing the scene as it's being shot with your music?
No, I tried to go on set when I can, and obviously, you know, I don't spend like huge amounts of time on set because I'm not, you know, I'm not really needed that much, but it's really amazing to see the process. And Todd was also, he was sending me dailies from scenes that they were shooting that where the music was really kind of influential in the process, and that was really, really, really beautiful to see how in Joker, like, how the music really was a part of the whole language of the film and the movements that were happening on set. And the beautiful thing with Joaquin's movements was that they were so connected to what I was feeling when I was writing the music, and I was almost feeling very similar types of movements, but I never told anyone that. Like, I never said anything. I just, you know, sent out the music and I was like, well, here's the music, and then I got this back, and it was just so, it was so wonderful, and it was like, it felt like such an incredibly beautiful, wordless dialogue, you know, where everyone could just focus on, you know, their medium, and it was such a beautiful thing to be a part of, you know. But on set, like, I think especially when you have an actor like Joaquin who's so deep in his character when he's acting, like, you really just don't want to disturb him, because, you know, he's really completely in his own universe, you know, and so you just want to let him do his thing.
Let him go, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
But you say that the Oscar process and the awards process, you feel like it happened to someone else, but you are working on another Joker, so this could all happen again. All fingers and all toes crossed. This could all happen again. You could relive that again. obviously, you can't tell. I understand that the movie's a little while away off yet, so I understand you. There's probably a lot that you can't tell us about it, and of course we won't ask. But how is it going in general, in a generic way that doesn't reveal too much? How is it going, and how much are you enjoying the process?
Well, I'm really deep into it right now. I'm staring at a session, like, you know, that I haven't
it's so tantalizing. It's just off screen.
So I can't really answer that question right now because I'm still just in the middle.
Yeah.
Let's see. But I hope it's going well. I guess so. Well, but it's really hard to know, you know, when you're in a project, it's so hard to evaluate it, you know, because you're just focusing on the tasks at hand, and then it's not really until it comes out and you can really step away from it to see, like, ah, okay, this is the big picture, because you're so kind of focused on these minuscule.
Yeah. You're so close to it.
Along the way, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you're just like, you know, you're struggling with a, you know, sample bank not responding to your MIDI keyboard or whatever, you know, that is, you know.
Well.
So it's hard to evaluate.
Not too much pressure, but we're all very excited for it.
Yeah.
All of us in the millions. So, yeah, not too much pressure.
It's the royal us. Everyone,
yeah. Sure.
Yeah, you mentioned there, like, when you're in the process and it's like you're so objectively working on getting the music done. And I wondered, like, have you ever, this always intrigues me, like, when a composer writes music for a film and then the film is out there with the score on it. Do you ever get, like, responses back from actors, like, do they, like, come up to you and, like, say afterwards about their, because I always want to know about how actors react when they hear scores from their films. Have you ever had an experience like that?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's very different between actors how much they engage with the music. Is I think it's very, very different between people, but yeah, no, I've definitely had, you know, a really, really great relationship with quite a few actors that have a really strong response to the music, and I guess, I mean, Kate Blanchett, for example, I mean, she's someone that's really, really engaged, you know, and it was an incredible, just really incredible experience to get to work with her on Tar, for example, because they're, obviously, I was, you know, I was writing the music for her character that she was supposed to be writing in the film. So we were obviously having, like, more of a dialogue than you would maybe normally have with an actor in a kind of normal film score. But it was really, really wonderful to experience how she feels the music, and she does so, like, very strongly, and that was very inspiring for me to have this dialogue with her, because she's also just such an amazing artist, you know, she's such a deep and articulate artist, you know, she's really so into it, and I think that's, yeah, that was a real privilege.
I mean, she literally became a conductor, didn't she? She became a conductor for the film. Yeah. So that must have just been an extraordinary collaboration, just to watch an actor go through that. But...
yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, not just any actor, but I think, you know, she's one of the few or the only person that could have really done it like this, you know. Because it's, you know, her range is just so magnificent, just in this one scene where she's walking into the, you know, onto the podium, and we see her face first in the dark, and then her face comes into the light, and just see the changes in her face, you know, it's so moving, you know, how much she can do with so little, you know, and it's so, so strong, you know, really, really amazing.
Just finally, before it's been so lovely to talk to you today. It's been a real pleasure. But just one last question before we go. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about Joker, which we can't talk too much about, of course. But what else are you working? Is that all you're kind of focused on at the moment? Are you working on other things as an artist, as a composer? What have you got coming up next that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, I have started, and then of course it got delayed because of the strike. But I've started working on an adaptation of Hedda Gabler.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a play by Ibsen, and I think that That'll be really, really lovely, I think. And it's with a director called Nia Da Costa, who's really, really exciting. And Nina Hass is in it again, who was in Tar. So it's like we're having a little bit of a Tar reunion.
Bit of reunion, yeah.
And some other wonderful artists also involved in that film. So I'm excited to get back on that when when the actor strike finishes, and then some bits and pieces of some new solo music and some other performances coming up, like with one of my bands, for example, which is like a robot metal band. We have a few shows coming up and a
Nice.
record in the making. So yeah, I'm not bored.
Busy and excited.
Yeah.
Hilda, thank you so much for your time. Good luck and every great success with everything you do next. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great
Thanks,
to be
Hilda.
with you. Thank you. Bye.
No one shall leave until I find if the living have been killed by the dead. You have been hiding here all this time.
Who are you talking to?
That was the marvellous Hilda Gudnadottir there, speaking this week with Sean Wilson and I about her work on many projects, including her most recent release, A Haunting in Venice, for Kenneth Branagh. The film is still playing in cinemas and theatres worldwide, and again, a big thank you to our friends at View Cinemas for making sure that I saw that in time. MyView.com to find your nearest View Cinema. Hilda's soundtrack for the film is currently available on Hollywood Records via the Disney Music Group, and to find out more about Hilda, check out her website at hildaness.com. That's HILDURNESS.com. Thank you to Hilda once again for a lovely interview. Thank you to Sean for being an excellent co-pilot. And thank you to all our friends at White Bear for making the arrangements, as well as all of our family at the Express FM studios where these episodes are made. And of course, thank you for listening. To get more updates, then, by all means, follow at Need a Bigger Pod on socials. I'm also at John Brown TV on all platforms. That's at JON at John Brown TV. Or you can follow Sean on X at Seano22. That's SEAN at Seano22. Or on Instagram at Sean Filmwriter. Until next time, thank you. And keep that soundtrack collection stacked very high, my friend.